We'll start off with this, and it's to do with the peopling of the Americas. This is, of course, a sensational headline from the Daily Mail, "Were Aborigines the First Americans?" But actually, the science behind this is even more sensational than the headlines. There's evidence for two founding populations of the Americas, and one of those founding populations didn't come this way. They crossed the Pacific Ocean. There is a strong genetic connection between indigenous Australians and Papuans and certain tribes in the Amazon rainforest. And that genetic connection is not found anywhere in North America. It's only found in South America and in Australasia. And furthermore, it's very ancient. A study published in Cell in 2018 examined skeletons from Lagoa Santa in Brazil dated to 10,400 years ago, and they contained this anomalous genetic signal. That tells us that people were coming from right across the Pacific Ocean to the Americas at least 10,500 years ago. We don't know how much older it goes before that. And of course, the mainstream is trying to say, no, they must have got there some other way. They couldn't possibly have sailed across the Pacific Ocean. It was a long-held view of geneticists that there was a single common, pretty recent origin for Native Americans as migrants across the so-called Bering land bridge when the Bering Straits were dry land. But this view is beginning to fall apart. The whole ice-free corridor idea is so full of problems that it's really no longer standing on its feet. As well as this connection between Australasia and South America, also being challenged is the long-established view of when and how the Americas were first peopled. And it's this Australasian DNA is very odd, because if the conventional view of the peopling of the Americas were correct, we would expect to find some remnants of that genetic signal in North America and in Central America, but we don't. We only find it in South America and in Australasia. And I talked to Eske Willislev in March 2018. He's one of the world's leading geneticists, and he admitted nobody has got a good explanation for this Australo-Melanesian signal. And he did accept that the simplest explanation was that someone holding this signal comes into the Americas, not through Beringia, but crossing into South America across the ocean. Based purely on the genetic data, this is the most parsimonious explanation, but it doesn't make practical sense. And I asked him, why doesn't it make practical sense? And he says, because archaeologists tell me that nobody could cross the Pacific Ocean at that time. Well, that's not good enough, because the genetic evidence says that somebody did. He's relying, I think, too much on the fixed archaeological dogma about the peopling of the Americas, a dogma that again and again has been proved wrong. This is Blackwater Draw. This is the original Clovis site, the first inhabitants of the Americas for a long time thought to be a culture called the Clovis culture. Why are they called the Clovis culture? Because the archaeologists could get beer in Clovis when they were working at Blackwater Draw. They couldn't get it at the Blackwater Draw. Intact and broken Clovis points, they're a very distinctive culture. I've shown you this picture of the Eloise mammoth being draped in the black mat full of those impact proxies. And now the questions are beginning to be asked. Here's new scientists that they're admitting that the established view for so long was that some 13,000 years ago, a group of people from Asia walked across a land bridge that connected Siberia to Alaska and headed south, the so-called Clovis culture. Well, there have been archaeologists who have reacted to this notion of Clovis first, that there were no human beings in America before 13,000 years ago. And one of the bravest is Jacques Cinq-Mars. And Jacques Cinq-Mars excavated Bluefish Caves in the Yukon, and he found evidence that human beings had been present there more than 20,000 years earlier, well before Clovis. Instead of his new discoveries at Bluefish Caves leading archaeologists to readjust their view about the peopling of the Americas. Instead of that happening, instead of saying, let's think about this, maybe we were wrong. What happened was that Jacques Cinq-Mars had his life ruined by fellow archaeologists. They turned on him like a pack of hyenas. They utterly destroyed him. They destroyed his morale. They destroyed his career. Research funding was withdrawn from him. He was blacklisted. He was just cut out completely. Colleagues would pass him in the corridors of the university and they would turn their faces away from him and not look at him. That's when you begin to realize with archaeology we're dealing with something like a dogmatic religion rather than with something that should properly be called a science. It was a brutal experience, something that's now being admitted. This is even Smithsonian admitting it. It was a brutal experience, something that Cinq-Mars once likened to the Spanish Inquisition. Audiences paid little heed to his presentation. Other researchers listened politely, then questioned his competence. The result was always the same. When Jacques proposed that Bluefish Caves was 24,000 years old, it was not accepted. Well, it's accepted now because Bluefish Caves have been thoroughly re-excavated. It's been published, and Bluefish Caves does indeed have absolutely incontrovertible evidence of human beings present there 24,000 years ago. Jacques Cinq-Mars was right all along, but the establishment turned upon him and destroyed him as an individual because he was saying something that they didn't agree with. Years later, they were forced to step back from that position. But they still don't want the Americas to have been peopled a very long time ago. There's still this tendency to say it must have been recent. This is the questions asked. Did archaeologists in the mainstream marginalize dissenting voices on this key issue? What was the impact on North American archaeology? This is Tom Dillehay. He was another who suffered the vicious attacks of the establishment. He's pretty polite about what happened to him. He was working at Monteverde, down in the tip of South America, and he found evidence of human beings being there long before Clovis. He became not the subject of interest, and let's look into it, but the subject of attacks. Now most archaeologists accept his evidence. Some were open to it before, but members of the Society for American Archaeology, the SAA, strongly resisted the mountains of compelling evidence he produced. And Dillehay was subject for decades to much the same sort of shitty abuse that Jacques Cinq-Mars was subject to. Society for American Archaeology, founded in 1934, quote, is an international organization dedicated to the research, interpretation, and protection of the archaeological heritage of the Americas. It has more than 7,000 members, etc. So here's Tom Dillehay talking about his experiences with his absolutely genuine discoveries at Monteverde, which are thousands of years older than Clovis.
I put together an interdisciplinary research team of people, got National Geographic funding and National Science Foundation funding, that went pretty well the way we expected it to. And I found that the scientists were open-minded. This includes archaeologists. We had Australian, Chilean, and Argentinian archaeologists working with us. Cumulatively speaking, those people besides myself probably had close to 100 years of experience amongst them. What surprised me on the other side of the coin was the stiff, closed-mindedness of many North American archaeologists. But some of the North American colleagues were very difficult to deal with, and I think at times presenting a very unhealthy atmosphere, cutting us off before we could present the data at meetings, not talking with us about it, refusing to even look at the data, this sort of thing.
So now we know that the Clovis was certainly not first, that the Americas have been populated for a very long time. These fossilized footprints from New Mexico go back maybe as much as 23,000 years. Our Goodyear's research at the University of South Carolina finding evidence at Topper of human beings being there 50,000 years ago. Al told me that he had to work against the dogma. The dogma was that there's no point. You know, in archaeology, deeper is older. The shallower it is, the younger it is. And he was being told by all colleagues as he was excavating Topper, there is no point in digging below the Clovis lair because there's nothing there. He dug anyway. And there was something there. Evidence of human beings going back 50,000 years. Needless to say, he suffered a great deal of hostility as a result of that. But I visited Topper with him, and he showed me how they'd gone down below the Clovis level. You can see it there, and what they'd found down there. And then this 130,000-year-old archaeological site in Southern California, published in Nature. I mean, this is serious. Steve Holland, Thomas Demaray, and others. This is in San Diego. And I went to the San Diego Natural History Museum, and I spent a couple of days with Tom Demaray, and he showed me their evidence. Well, their evidence is not of a high civilization in the Americas 130,000 years ago. The evidence is of the presence of humans. And what they found was mastodon bones, which had been deliberately fractured using tools to extract the marrow from the bones. And needless to say, suggesting that human beings had been in the Americas for 10 times as long as Clovis brought down a thunder of attacks upon Tom Demaray and his team. But they've stayed solid. The critics attacked the study that rewrote the human arrival. Debate heats up. But they have published responses to all of those criticisms. It's an ongoing fight. I am pretty sure we're going to find that human beings have been in the Americas for longer than there were human beings in Europe. I think we're going to find that out. And the evidence of the San Diego research is already proving that. So the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, we've been talking about that. And we've been talking about the unprincipled attacks upon it by certain scientists who just keep on attacking it. Here's Apocalypse by Mark Boslow. Mark Boslow is one of those scientists who constantly attacks the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. And what he's got here, comment on this, Graham Hancock is a charlatan and fraud. The Younger Dryas impact hypothesis has been widely debunked by experts from multiple academic fields. If you want to learn about work done by actual academics in related fields, then you should follow K.U. Hoops, that's John Hoops, another horrible creature, and Mark Boslow. Actually, as Alan said, the number of people who are launching these attacks on the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis is very small, but they are extremely vocal, and they're bullies, and they bully other scientists into following them along without even necessarily verbally agreeing with them. Again, we've had the responses to these critiques, which I've talked about earlier. Gunung Padang, Jakarta, there, West Java. This extraordinary megalithic site that we featured as episode one in season one of Ancient Apocalypse. Danny Hillman is a highly qualified Caltech-trained geologist, and he has used the latest technology working on this obviously man-made site on the top, but he's been investigating the inner depths of it and found evidence of human construction going back 27,000 years into the past. It's older than 9,000 years, could be more than 20,000 years. It's a strong case, but not an easy case. We're up against the world's belief. This is an artist's impression of what Gunung Padang would have, on the right, of what it would have looked like in antiquity. And again, this has been subject to vicious attacks, and from the same group of people. John Hoops at Kansas University, Flint Dibble at the University of Cardiff, and others. Why did poor Danny's work get attacked by archaeologists? Because he'd been on my show. It's as simple as that. If he hadn't been on my show, what happened to his paper would never have happened. He published a paper about Gunung Padang. That paper was peer-reviewed, and it was accepted for publication. But then the Flint Dibbles and the John Hoops started to come in and spread all kinds of shit over all of this, and we get press articles. Really, really weak experts attack claim that Indonesia's site is world's oldest building. And it goes on. Here is Flint Dibble claiming that there's nothing at all to see at Gunung Padang, and we shouldn't waste our time on it. And Flint being Flint has caused a lot of trouble for Danny. Here's Danny, just a few words.
And reporter called me and asking me, do you know there's an investigation on your paper? I said, no. And they showed me the articles, and I'm just surprised. Oh, my God.
So what happened? Flint Dibble and Ken Farley decided that they didn't like what your paper was implying, and so they were going to attack it.
Flint Dibble and Ken Farley appears on that article by Danny Lewis in Nature. So, and that's two archaeologists has been like become our opponents in the mass media.
Has he ever been to Indonesia, do you know?
No, he haven't.
He's never seen the site.
No, it's always back to the comments by Flint Dibble, the archaeologist. So it's become like the front opponent of our paper.
So here he is. He managed to get Danny's paper retracted. He brought archaeologists to put pressure on the journal, and eventually they crumbled under that pressure and they retracted the paper. And here's a little bit of a clip from Flint's derisive attitude towards a very serious researcher.
Harry, do you want to expand on any of these points or bring up a different point of view of your thoughts on this article?
I will criticism about the author first.
Okay.
If you see the authors is there is a Danny Hillman, and the others is you can see only one, the archaeologist.
Who is the archaeologist? The one archaeologist?
Archaeologist is the only
Ali Akbar.
Ali Akbar.
Okay.
Ali Akbar. So it's
and everyone
only
else.
Ali
Akbar. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
11 is the geologist. All the geography and the geologist. It's not the archaeologist.
Wait. They have one sentence. Yeah. They say, on top of this buried, decayed rock mass, a unique stone artifact resembling a traditional Sundanese dagger called Kujang stone was discovered. That is all they say. Is that how you identify artifacts?
In Indonesia, denied of the oldest pyramid. So I think it's only Ali Akbar who support him for this one.
He's the only one. There's only one that supports
the only
him.
One.
I think
wow.
I mean, because I don't find the any person and the Graham Hancock too. Mm-hmm. It's a circle of the pseudo science for me. So it's not his circle is not the archaeologists. You know, the ordinary people or the people in the outside. They waiting our research, and they waiting what we say, because they always believe what we say. The archaeologists said we said is the civilization. Okay, it's civilization. It's like that, because we are the researcher. We are the archaeologists.
So you see the problem. The problem is that only if archaeologists say that Danny is right, is he right. If anybody else says he's right, they don't care. Archaeology is to have the final word on the past. So Flint Dibble rounds up a couple of others from Indonesia who already have conflicts of interest with Danny. Over that specific site, and he uses them as witnesses against Danny. There is a fight for the past, and it's affecting not only people like me, it's affecting mainstream researchers like Danny Hillman as well. So there's the retracted paper. And we've published Danny's response to that on my website. It's there in great depth. I won't read it all to you here, but he's given a very detailed response. And interestingly, in the comments on that response, we had a response from a geologist, Tristan Childress, who says that the journal's decision is absolutely baffling. And here's what he has to say about it.
So this video is for Danny Hillman, Nana Wijaya, and co-authors of the recently retracted archaeological paper on Gunung Padang. I just wanted to offer my condolences for your paper retraction, and I wanted to express my disdain for the way that you've been treated in social media channels, as well as in some mass media channels. I've read your paper. Your team has done a really excellent job of data collection. You have done some really excellent prospecting work, and I think the core of your interpretations are entirely valid. And so for a journal to retract your paper solely on the basis of disagreement from what I have to assume are a handful of heavyweights within your realm is highly unusual. And I think it shows poor form on the part of the journal, and that they probably caved to pressure from people that didn't like your interpretations. So anyway, I hope that you guys continue your work there. I hope you can keep collecting data, keep digging, and I hope that you intend to republish. So keep up the good work, guys.
That's the kind of scientist we need, you know? And Robert Schock as well. Robert and I visited Gunung Padang together, and I think Robert has been back separately, but here's what Robert has to say. This is from an interview that he gave to Atlantis Rising magazine.
I am talking there with Dr. Danny Hilman Natawijaja. He is a native Indonesian, although he has been trained overseas from Indonesia and New Zealand. He got his PhD at the California Institute of Technology, his PhD in specializing in geology and tectonics and earthquake prediction, that type of thing. So a remarkable man. He and I got along very well. I really enjoyed visiting with him and discussing it. And he is the person who has actually been leading the geological team at the moment studying Gunung Padang. Something that is really important and interesting to me is that it's not just the surface features that we have at Gunung Padang, but he has been able to probe down about 15, 20 or more meters in depth. And he and his team have done this a number of different ways. They've used electrical resistivity, which people may or may not be familiar with. It's something I've certainly worked with as a geologist. He's used ground penetrating radar, which many people are familiar with. It's a popular way to study below surface structures nowadays. He's used seismic, as I have used around the Great Sphinx in Egypt, to model what is underneath Gunung Padang. And he's actually had the opportunity with his group to drill. So he's drilled boreholes down into the structure, received permission to do that. So he has a lot of subsurface data. And he was able to demonstrate to me with this data that these structures, these artificial structures that we see on the surface, go down a depth of 10 to 15 meters or even a bit more, depending on where you are on the hill, on the mountain. So this is not just a surficial feature. It's not just on the surface. It goes down to this incredible depth, which again indicates how old the structure is and how sophisticated it is. And in the boreholes that he took, he brought up samples of the rock and the sediment. And in some of those boreholes, he found artificial cements, he believes, which are very sophisticated for such an ancient structure. And he also found material that has carbon in it, which could be used for radiocarbon dating. And it's this radiocarbon dating that has really allowed him to get a handle on exactly how old the structure is.
So you're talking about, what's he saying, 12,000 years?
There's several different layers that he has identified. This is typical when you're a geologist and you're doing this type of work. You tend to find different distinct layers, and that's typical of archaeological sites. He has identified five major layers going down to about 15 plus meters, and the oldest one, so that would be the lowest one on the bottom, is 20-some thousand years old, actually probably more like 22, 23, maybe a bit older, 1,000 years. So about 20,000 BC, let's think in those terms. And then working up the layer, there's layer 4, then there's layer, what he calls layer 3. And layer 3 is actually the most interesting to me because I think it has very good data. He's got several dates for this radiocarbon, and they come in at the very end of the last ice age, about 10,000, 11,000 BC, in that range. And this is, to me, incredibly interesting because this layer, from what we can see seismically, the geophysics looks like it's very sophisticated, as we see on the surface with those types of structures. It dates back to the end of the last ice age, the same time that I've been talking about for a long time with my work on the Sphinx, for instance.
So again, you know, we have a very interesting site with huge potential for revealing more about the human story. And again, archaeologists have teamed up to crush it. All research has been stopped there. Danny is hoping with the new regime in Indonesia now that he may be able to get that research restarted. The interesting thing is that the president who listened to the archaeologists and stopped the research, I'm going to get into a bit of a conspiracy theory here, Joko Widodo is a member of the World Economic Forum. And this is a matter that also comes up at Göbekli Tepe. At any rate, that site of Gunung Padang on the island of Java, during the Ice Age, there was no island of Java. The entire Malaysian Peninsula, all the Indonesian islands, Borneo, they were all joined into a huge landmass above water. And to find now a site that may be more than 20,000 years old on Indonesia, and just to throw it away and not pay any more attention to it, given this extraordinary background, is just nuts in my view. This was a fertile, extraordinary place to live in during the Ice Age. It was warm, it was nourishing, it was exactly the kind of place that human populations would have gone to during the Ice Age. It's exactly the kind of place where we might rightly expect to find structures more than 20,000 years old. Yes, 2012. And the whole phenomenon around 2012. A widespread belief fueled by misinterpretations of the Mayan calendar that cataclysmic events would occur on or around December 21st, 2012. You have to understand that when critics direct themselves at issues like this, they often misrepresent what they're presenting to the public. They create their own interior image of it, and they project that and they attack that rather than what is actually being said. Particularly suffering from the critics of the 2012 issue was John Major Jenkins. John Major Jenkins was a great man, in my view. We have a number of individuals in this field who have done truly remarkable work. Robert Schock, John Anthony West, Robert Bavall, and I include John Major Jenkins amongst them. He was a friend of mine. He was a really good man. He was an intensely focused scholar. There was nothing sensationalistic about what John did. He made a deep study of the Mayan calendar and of what it's based upon. But he was attacked as supposedly being one of the principal figures who promoted the idea that the ancient Mayan calendar portended major changes on Earth in 2012. That was not John's position at all. Luckily, my son Luke interviewed John back in 2010. John passed away from liver cancer in 2017. And I'll tell you frankly, and John told me this, and I saw it happening to him, the corrosive criticism, the constant attacks, the humiliations that he received from the establishment and their friends in the media wore him down. I think he'd still be with us if it hadn't been for those attacks. I think those attacks destroyed his immune system and allowed that cancer to come through. Anyway, here is John in 2010.
You know, the reason the Mayan calendar is famous to us today, and the reason why we care about it, is because they have this idea of a great ending of the cycle in December 21st, 2012. Mm-hmm. So why did they pinpoint December 21st, 2012, and what did they think about it?
Oh, great. Yeah, well, according to my research, the reason why they pinpointed this date, it's a solstice, so it probably has something to do with astronomy. And there's some intentionality behind it. That was the vector for me back around 1990 in investigating this. To cut to the chase, and according to my research, there is a rare astronomical alignment that's culminating in the years around 2012. It's caused by the precession of the equinoxes. Precession causes the equinoxes and the solstices to shift backwards along the ecliptic. And in the years around 2012, the position of the December solstice will be lined up with the bright band of the Milky Way, specifically a part that is visible to the naked eye astronomers called the Dark Rift. So the galactic alignment is the alignment of the December solstice sun with the Dark Rift in the Milky Way. And this is a fact of astronomy that happens in the years around 2012.
As a matter of fact, it's not a single date. It's a window. This is observational astronomy. And that window is about 72 years wide, about 1 degree of precession wide, rounded up to 80 years. So again, precession is involved, and John is telling us, notice the phenomenon of precession is causing the position of the December solstice sun to converge with the creation place, this central bulge in the Milky Way. And he draws his data from Izapa, Chiapas in Mexico.
And I believe that the site of Azapa is responsible for the formulation of the long count cosmology. And I kind of make a distinction between the cosmology and the calendar because I think that the cosmology came first. In other words, the astronomers realized that there was going to be a future convergence between the December solstice sun and the dark rift in the Milky Way. That became a very potent mythological idea that they very quickly formulated into this creation mythology story about the future rebirth of the father of the hero twins and how that happens. The father of the hero twins being a symbol for the December solstice sun that would get reborn at the end of the cycle.
See, this is the point. John's position was never that the world is going to end on the 21st of December 2012. His position was that we are entering an era of change and that we will be reborn, that there will be a rebirth of humanity. It's not a message of doom and destruction. It's a message of the end of an age and the beginning of another age. John was hugely misrepresented on this issue. And it's the cosmic rebirth of the sun from the womb of the galaxy. The former world age ends. The new world age begins. And this is the key thing, that the limitations of naked eye astronomy and the diameter of the sun itself, we're not looking at an instant or even a specific day, but a window in time, several decades wide. And it is a fact, it's an absolute fact in the Mayan calendar that the end of the age is the 21st of December 2012, but this is based on astronomical observations and there has to be some naked eye flexibility around that.
In the calendar, in the long count calendar, with the correlation that we know, we can say that the end of the 13 Bakhtun cycle falls on a specific day. It's just part of the mechanics of the calendar. So December 21st of 2012, according to the correlation that, you know, is confirmed by the surviving Dzogchen count in the highlands of Guatemala and so on. But to the extent that 2012 is talked about as some kind of transformation, I don't think we can think of it as some kind of definitive thing that's going to happen exactly on that day. You know, I just don't think that it's something that's built into the architecture of time in that way. So the alignment itself, the galactic alignment, doesn't happen specifically and only on December 21st of 2012. It's such a slow process that you'd have to really think about what I like to think about as a 36-year window. But that, again, doesn't imply that everything's going to happen inside of that 36-year window. You know, we have to become more sophisticated in how we think about the 2012 tradition.
36-year window being half a degree of precession. I think a degree of precession is more likely.
So the idea of doomsday is something that we've made up. It's not something the Mayans actually talked about.
Well, it's definitely something that's been projected unduly onto 2012. I mean, I like to go to the core of the tradition, which I believe is basically in the ball court at the site of Azapa, some 2,100 years ago. And the carved monuments there definitely tell us how the originators of this long count cosmology thought about 2012. So conclusion, transformation, and renewal. But throughout Mesoamerican history and Mayan history, you are going to find examples, just like you'll find in any tradition, a whole spectrum of ideas that accrete around a certain idea, especially something like a huge cycle ending. And in the world age doctrine, which is very central to the Popol Vuh creation myth, you can have sort of a more literal interpretation of what is entailed in a period ending, which would be more dramatic and sensationalized, something that you would maybe present to a certain sector of the society. But then the deeper part of the tradition and the ideation around it, I think, always involves the challenge of successfully facilitating a transformation and renewal.
So it's not about the end of the world. It's about a transformation and a renewal. The ancient Maya believed that the years around 2012, that window in time, would be attended by great changes. And in accordance with their world age creation mythology, the transformation of human beings into something completely new. Am I wrong to have this intuition that we are indeed living in such a time at the moment, that humanity is going through a crisis, and that we must emerge from this crisis with a rebirth. This is the opportunity that a crisis offers, not to dive deeper into the crisis and embed ourselves even deeper into the mud of it, but to see it as an opportunity for rebirth and regrowth. I think there's something to this whole thing. John never claimed that the Mayan calendar prophesied cataclysmic earth changes on the 21st of December 2012. His view was that entirely different kinds of changes were envisaged. And he saw this as being spread out through what he called a 36-year window between 1994 and 2030, exactly the window that we're living in now. I suggest a little bit more might make sense. Anyway, John was massively attacked. The media branded 2012 as a doomsday trigger. They ignored all his evidence. He published a book on this shortly before he died, Ivory Tower, House of Cards, How Scholars and Their Publishers Violate Science. And who was his main attacker? John Hoops from the University of Kansas. John Hoops, who is hand in glove with Flint Dibble, who selectively cherry-picked the things that John had stated and used them in attacks on him. I'm not going to go through this here, but John Hoops was constantly misrepresenting John Major Jenkins' work, fishing for useful bits of personal history, and possibly jealous. Every scholar wants their work to be read by millions and to make a breakthrough contribution, but few actually do. It's unacceptable to them when an outsider does this, one who doesn't swallow goldfish at fraternity hazing parties, or worse, and who didn't go into debt paying the piper through years of boring classes. They engage in vague citation practices, insinuations of unscientific methods, guilt by association constructs, and assertions that are not verifiable and are not supported by the source they cite. And indeed, when challenged on this, they don't respond to the challenge. They create another challenge in their minds and respond to that. Speaking of John Hoops here, John Major Jenkins, in that last book of his, said he circularly tries to legitimize his flawed ideas by citing Wikipedia entries he himself has helped to craft. He often just makes baseless assertions of a damaging nature regarding living authors. And here's Wikipedia still sticking that pseudoscientific researcher on John Major Jenkins, who was a dedicated, thorough, excellent researcher. Well, they stick the same label on me. Pseudoscientific ideas about ancient civilizations. And lo and behold, John Hoops has put himself forward as the person who the media must contact in order to tell them the truth about the horrible Graham Hancock and his awful ideas. So he puts himself out to comment on ancient apocalypse. And he said he's available to comment on how pseudo-archaeology and Hancock's writings align with and reinforce white supremacist dogma. My goodness, I mean, whenever you start hearing words like this being applied, you realize that somebody is trying to cancel you. Archaeologists and experts say that the series presents pseudo-scientific claims, cherry picks. Hancock's complaints about mainstream archaeology is one-sided, evocative of conspiracy theories. This is another part of the language of cancellation, is call something a conspiracy theory. Keep calling it that, and you hope that the theory will go away. Oh, dear. There, look what's on his desk. I mean, the sign and the seal, talisman, magician of the gods. The guy is obsessed with me. He's been following my research for 30 years. It's like having a very ugly, very weird stalker following me around through time. And he terms my milieu the cultic milieu of conspiracy theory, which once embraced opens the door to such real-world dangers as vaccination conspiracies and climate change and election denial. God, these people. So here's the Society for American Archaeology with its 7,000 members, of whom one is John Hoops, and John Hoops played a role in the writing of this open letter to Netflix. They wrote to Netflix a few days after season one was launched to express their concern about the series. because it publicly disparages archaeologists and devalues the archaeological profession. For these reasons, we call upon both Netflix and ITN Productions, that's the production company that made the show with me, to remove any labels that state or imply that this series is a factual documentary, and reclassify this series as science fiction. They wanted my series to be reclassified as science fiction. What a clever way, if they'd pulled that off, to get me cancelled. That way they couldn't be accused of actually demanding that the series be pulled off the air entirely. But at the same time, if Netflix had bowed to that pressure and had reclassified it as science fiction, it wouldn't have got any audience at all. So undoubtedly, the SAA was seeking to cancel me. And they claim they find no evidence for advanced global ice age civilization. I'm sorry, there's a lot of evidence, but it's not the kind of evidence that archaeologists like. Again, this science fiction demand. I responded to it in depth on my website. You can still find it there in my blog. I've taken every single point that they make and refuted those points. But you can see what happened. There was this massive media explosion. Fishy Netflix Atlantis show needs big pinch of salt, say archaeologists. Ancient Apocalypse is the most dangerous show on Netflix. I mean, you know, I'm looking at a possible alternative view of the past, and it's dangerous. It's dangerous. What the hell is going on there? And here, the most dangerous show on Netflix, it whispers to the conspiracy theorist in all of us. That word, conspiracy theorist, keeps on coming up again and again, and the annoyance and anger that the show is a hit, that it's being appreciated by audiences around the world. So there was a whole slew of articles, all picking up from John Hoops and Flint Dibble attacking Ancient Apocalypse. Ugh, it just goes on and on and on. And here's an interesting example. This is a newspaper called The Independent in Britain, where we do have public-funded television like the BBC. And they're saying Netflix's Ancient Apocalypse is the best case for publicly-funded TV yet, because it's exposing a dangerous conspiracy theory, and what's needed is regulated broadcasting, so that Netflix would never be allowed to publish anything to do with me. And then if they can't get it cancelled, which they didn't, and season two comes along, the next step is to mock it, to throw mockery at it. So any Ice Age telepaths out there, please explain why Netflix is revisiting Ancient Apocalypse. 2 years earlier in that Guardian article, they'd asked, why is it even allowed? Who would be the person who allowed it or didn't allow it? I mean, what is going on here? Do we live in a free society where people can express their opinions and views, or do we not? Flint Dibble, of course, got in on the act. I took on a pseudoscientist because misinformation about history too often goes unchallenged. And of course, there he is in the Society for American Archaeology Archaeological Record, co-authoring an article with John Hoops. I wonder why Flint gets so worked up about all this. He keeps claiming that, you know, I've got this massive platform with Netflix, and poor archaeologists, they don't have anything like the platform I have. And yet, in his own words, of course he claimed that he put scare quotes around it, but he says that we live in a period with increasing distrust of scholars, and we do. In many ways, the reach of big archaeology is way beyond that of Graham Hancock. Now, whether he put it in scare quotes or not, what he says next is really interesting, and it's true. Think about the millions of school children, parents and tourists who visit museums or sites near home on vacation. The numbers dwarf any reach that the fake archaeology entertainment business has. So he's telling us that he thinks archaeology does dominate human understanding of the past, and yet he's really upset by somebody else who suggests that there might be a different interpretation of the past. I just don't get it. I don't understand how those two frames of mind can be accommodated in the same brain. Unless it's a kind of macho pissing contest kind of thing. This is the sort of stuff that Flint published afterwards, a picture of him slam dunking me. Yes. And then this. I forgot the most important point, the proof that I destroyed Graham Hancock. I mean, this is a pissing contest, isn't it? he lost fair and square to a real archaeologist. And then this, my only response was to make it seem that he lied, a ridiculous and cheap ploy. And here he is with his team. There's Milo Rossi, Minuteman, Stefan Milo and Bill Farley and Jason Colavito, World of Antiquity. They're all grouped together, determined to destroy any hint of disagreement with the mainstream view. And even when what they state publicly turns out actually to be a lie, archaeologists circle the wagons around them. They don't call them out for the lies. They rather protect them. And actually, they gave Flint Dibble an award, the Ockham Award, precisely for debating me on the Joe Rogan Show. Laud him and appraise him and, hugely value him. The lie, here is Flint defining what a lie is. To make an untrue statement with intent to deceive, to create a false or misleading impression. And he says here, I've never called Graham Hancock a racist or white supremacist. There is nothing where I even insinuated it. This is a little extract from a video I've made fact-checking Flint Dibble.
On 16th April 2024, during the debate itself, when Flint confidently proclaimed,
I did not say that Graham reinforces white supremacist ideas.
On the same day, however, he had arranged for an article that he had pre-written to be published in Sapiens Anthropology magazine, in which he states, Hancock and other pseudo-archaeologists center white Europeans as able creators, while chalking up the accomplishments of other peoples to outside influences, end quote. Which of Flint Dibble's two statements is true? The one made on the JRE, or the one in Sapiens Anthropology magazine?
You see, I don't see how he can say, I've never suggested or said that Hancock's a white supremacist, and at the same time say that I center white Europeans as able creators while chalking up the accomplishments of other peoples to outside influences. As a matter of fact, I've never written about white Europeans in any of my books or talked about them. I've never seen Europe as a likely place to look for a lost civilization of the Ice Age. Why? Because Europe was a frozen wilderness during the Ice Age. It was the last place that anybody would have wanted to live. The place to look for a lost civilization is down near the tropics and the equator. That would have been the nurturing territory during the Ice Age. So I've never said anything about white Europeans being able creators. But Flint says I said that. And he lies. That is a lie. That is a straightforward lie, according to his definition. Secondly, they keep saying that I said I had no evidence.
For example, on 4th May 2024, interviewed by Indy 100 for an article modestly titled How I Took on Joe Rogan and Graham Hancock and Won, Dibble had the following to say. Quote, I'll be optimistic and say that I won, Dibble laughed, noting that a quarter of the way through their discussion, at 1 hour 27 minutes to be precise, Hancock clearly admitted that there is at present no evidence for an advanced civilization. On X on 20th June 2024, Dibble doubled down on his claim that I had admitted there is no evidence for my proposed lost civilization of the Ice Age. Some readers of this post might have been persuaded, as Dibble obviously intended, that after devoting more than 30 years of my life to investigating the possibility of a lost civilization of the Ice Age, and publishing thousands of pages on the subject supported by detailed footnotes as to sources, I still had no evidence for its existence. And even the small proportion who did go on to click the link at the end of the post might not have realized that I was being quoted out of context. Here's the full exchange on this subject.
I have to really repeat myself here.
Yeah, I can go back up there.
We're looking at
Bimini.
Less than 5% of the continental shelves that have been studied at all by archaeology. I'm not surprised that we find hunter-gatherer traces underwater. I'm very glad that we do. I would be very surprised if we didn't. But what I'm saying is that not enough of that 27 million square kilometers has been investigated. Only a tiny fraction has been investigated. And that fraction is not enough to draw the conclusion that we can absolutely say there was no lost civilization. Same goes for the Amazon rainforest. Same goes for the Sahara Desert.
But can we say there's no evidence for an advanced civilization in what they have studied?
In what they have studied, yes, we can say there's no evidence for an advanced civilization. But that brings us to another issue of what is studied and what is not studied by archaeology.
And this is the crucial point, which I would have driven home at much greater length if I'd known that my opponent would later take the rest of the exchange out of context and use it against me. In the archaeological sites I'm interested in, the Great Pyramid and the Great Sphinx of Giza, for example, or Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, or Serpent Mound in Ohio, or the Moai of Easter Island, I draw extensively on data gathered by archaeologists. Indeed, I've stated frequently that without their data, none of my work would have been possible. But I don't study what they study. I look in the same directions they do, but my focus is entirely different.
And that's the key point. I don't study what archaeologists study. Sure. There's a lot of really useful and valuable information that archaeology has generated that is highly valued by me. But I'm not an archaeologist, and I'm not looking at this as an archaeologist, and I'm much less interested in artifacts that can be weighed, measured, and counted than I am in other issues like astronomy, like geology, like the mythology that comes down to us from the past, like the ancient scriptural texts, the ancient Egyptian pyramid texts, and so on and so forth. I'm interested in things that can't be weighed, measured, and counted. And that's why I've written thousands of pages on this and documented my findings very thoroughly with footnotes. The problem is I'm not doing what archaeologists do, and they feel that if you don't do what archaeologists do, you don't have any right to talk about the past at all. Dan, will you come and join me? Oh, come and join me. But I've got one more tiny thing to say. Sit, take a seat. I've got one more tiny thing to say. I get this on my Google alerts or something, the Lionel Nation. Normally I ignore what he says, but this was an interesting piece. He talked about the context behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the feeling that the Warren Commission was under heavy fire. This growing skepticism alarmed the CIA, as maintaining public confidence in government institutions was a key priority during the Cold War. So they drafted a document outlining a strategy to suppress alternative narratives. And that document involved constantly using the word conspiracy theory against alternative narratives and suggesting that the people proposing the views that ran contrary to the mainstream were only doing it for financial reasons. So conspiracy theory became associated with irrational paranoia. And again, these same words are being thrown at me as though I don't know what the conspiracy is. I never really felt that there was a conspiracy involving archaeologists, but I'm beginning to now. And again, this sort of thing, the most dangerous show, the conspiracy, the need to have regulated television so that ideas like mine can't get out. It's interesting that the same media assets that were used by the CIA on the Nixon issue are being used, on the Kennedy issue are being used against alternative archaeology. So I'm not saying it's a conspiracy, but we shall see. So, Dan has become a dear friend in the last year. Dan runs a most unusual YouTube channel called Dedunking. And I urge everybody in this room, subscribe to Dedunking, because Dan is doing really important work. Dan is not on one side or the other. He's going to debunk anything that seems like bullshit to him. But I have to say that you've been finding a lot of bullshit in the mainstream position. Tell us about yourself, Dan. Tell us about your channel. Tell us about how you got into this.
Oh, well, thank you. First of all, Graham, I really want to thank you for having me here. This is quite the honor. I've been following you for a long time. I pre-ordered Fingerprints of the Gods because I'd read Sign of the Seal already. Great. So that's how I got into this. I was been into this since kind of day one from your work. When I made my first videos, I was surprised that people that were debunking Ancient Apocalypse had basically, it looked like they didn't really know what your position was. They'd manufactured this kind of bullshit straw man, and they were just tilting at windmills. And so I started making videos to address that, and slowly over time, by the time of the debate, Flint really, in front of millions of people, he just openly lied. It wasn't mistakes. It wasn't at times like when Joe pressed him on the racism thing. He's squirming. That's not manufactured. But putting a graph on the screen and saying, well, that there was no metallurgy 12,000 years ago, but the graph only goes back 6,000 years. It's like, oh, dude, this is smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
This is so I love science. I'm not just. I don't just love science and the fact that I like the knowledge that we get and that it's fun to watch NOVA. Like Carl Sagan said, science is more than a body of knowledge. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of skeptically interrogating the universe. And it frustrates me because the debunking community, the debunking industry, as you so rightfully call it, is really they just manufacture kind of this bullshit pseudo-scientific position in order to sell a fake bill of goods. I can prove a negative. And basically, at the end of the day, you ask a question, and they're like, I can prove that's wrong. How can you prove that?
You prove that something didn't exist?
None of us know what happened 20,000 years ago, right? And it's almost like if you wrote a fiction and they wrote a fiction, they're like angry that their fiction isn't as popular as yours, but they've got more letters next to their name. It's clearly about ego.
yeah, very definitely. I've seen that you yourself have come under sustained attack from the same group of people, and it's interesting how they always use ad hominem attacks. So they're attacking you for a lack of credentials in this area. Well, let me make my position clear. Credentials don't matter a damn. Credentials are not important. It is the life work of the person that is important. I don't care what letters somebody's got after their name. I care what that person does. And I've watched what you do, and what you do is brilliant. But tell us about your background.
I'm a blue-collar electrician with a GED. I dropped out of college. I like science a lot. I mean, I'm a nerd. I played all Dungeons and Dragons and Magic the Gathering and all that bullshit all my life. I'm a nerd, right? But I liked Doctor Who before it was cool, man. I loved the pyramids and stuff. I loved ancient history has always been something that I was really into, and Egypt was interesting to me at a young age. I had in fourth grade, our art teacher had a Egypt day, and the juxtaposition of all this weird religious baggage, it seemed like this so cultish, the way she portrayed it anyway, coupled with these crazy monuments and all this beautiful iconography, I was just hooked at 10 years old. But then by the time I read The Sign and the Seal, that really changed my mind. Having grown up in a very Christian home, that really just kind of blew open the doors on what could be. And then Fingerprints of the Gods, and now we're here.
yeah. What would you say the objective of your channel is when you set it up? I mean, you call it de-dunking, which is dunking is an American.
You just showed the meme, right?
Yeah.
Fuck that noise. I'm sorry. get the ball right out. If somebody comes along and they prove what you have to say wrong, and they do it through the proper means and the proper channel, that's fine and good. And yet, as you yourself said today, you've changed your position on the Earth crust displacement theory. That's how this kind of thing works, if you're an honest person. But the guys that come along, and again, it's a job for them, so they can't The best example to me is the Baghdad Battery, because the way Milo Rossi just came in there and he just attacks it, and it's like, it doesn't take much research at all to see that the mainstream archaeologists will be like, well, fuck, it could have made electricity otherwise, I don't really know what to tell you. But he didn't go there because he did all the stuff that quote-unquote pseudoscientists do. He started backwards, he eliminated all the evidence that doesn't support his position, and he took only the things that did support his position. Preconceived notion, ta-da. But he doesn't give a shit. He doesn't care, because it's a manufactured product. It's just about making a dollar.
Yeah.
That's fine and good if you're just talking about movies or something, I suppose. But when you're like talking about things like when it gets to the point where they start personal attacks, I guess mm-hmm. that's where it really gets bad. Like you mentioned John Major Jenkins' health. And it goes even beyond that in my mind. It's like some people can handle, like Jimmy, he can handle a fight. I thrive on it. Bring it. Professor Dave has got one coming. I'm so happy that he made
it. I want to talk to you about that in a minute.
he's gonna be sorry he made that video. But some people don't thrive on that. And that's, to be succinct about it, I would rather stand between those assholes and you and let you talk about big rocks, and I'll talk to them.
That's sweet.
And not just you, but that's the community in general. I think people like that's, I guess, to sound arrogant about it, I'd try to stand as a bulwark between the investigative people and the scientists that want to poo-poo on everything.
Yeah, but I also regard you as highly objective, because you've criticized my work too. You know.
Yeah, thank you. I try not to be a butt about it, but if somebody's really searching for the truth, I don't think they'll have a problem with having their work criticized some. I certainly don't have a problem with that. But if it's when people get their egos attached.
Yeah. 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 And when the nature of the attacks actually really have very little to do with the ideas being discussed, and tend to be almost always variations on attacks on the person, ad hominem attacks. It just happens again and again and again.
Absolutely. It's like you mentioned with the Comet Research Group, those guys have been marginalized so hard that many people would consider them pseudoscientists, even though they're all credentialed. And the only thing that these guys have against it is smoke and mirrors. I mean, it's too much to get into. But like the biggest criticisms, I dug into it. And like Mark Boslow, he's created some just outright bullshit. But if you look at it if you're into science and you look at what he says on its face, it's like, oh, damn, that's pretty savage. But then you dig into it, it's like, oh, wait a minute, that's just bullshit. Mm-hmm. And that's one example of many. These guys, I'm not really sure if it's, I tend to not think it's a conspiracy as much as it's just like human ego and just mm-hmm. like one-upsmanship. But man, these guys are just hell-bent on not being wrong, especially not being wrong to somebody without the right letters next to their name. Oh my God, that's unthinkable.
Yes, yeah, definitely. I mean, you've yourself come under increasing attack, and you mentioned this, what's he called, Professor?
Professor Dave, yes.
Professor Dave. There's a new video out attacking me and you and Jimmy Corsetti, right?
Correct.
And the videos, I haven't watched all of it yet. I've looked at bits of it. It's really disgusting, in every possible way. But it reminds me of the earlier video that was done by Mini Minuteman Milo Rossi when Ancient Apocalypse was first released. It's made me realize that out there on the internet is a class of parasite. And that class of parasite looks for people who have got some level of recognition, who have perhaps large numbers of followers, who've become prominent in some way. And then the technique is to attack that person in every possible way you can, to insult them, to try to humiliate them. And this is what draws in audiences, and the audiences draw in money, and these parasites collect the money as a result of doing that. I don't think their heart's in it. I don't think that they really feel that passionately, that strongly, that the people they're attacking are wrong. I just think they see a money-making opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the best barometers for that, in my opinion, can be seen in the UFO community right now, when you've got the same United States federal government that professional skeptics have been citing for the last 30, 40 years, saying, well, you know, here's some stuff that we heard. And so these guys are out there now saying that, well, I know how to read the radar better than pilots, and I don't trust the United States government anymore. And it's the professional skeptic, just they have to keep playing the same tune no matter which direction the drummer runs. Yeah. They just got to keep playing that same tune. And it's really frustrating when it comes to these things, because situations like with you, where it becomes, they try, it almost becomes like a gish gallop. If they can get Graham Hancock to spend enough time fighting with the Flint Dibbles, then we don't get Ancient Apocalypse season 3.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Fuck those guys.
It's very much about that. Now, the new video, which is attacking you and attacking me and attacking Jimmy Corsetti, have you had a chance to look at the whole thing?
I haven't watched the whole thing. I've thankfully got followers that send me the appropriate clips, so I just watch bits and pieces.
Yeah, yeah. What's your overall estimation of that at this point?
Oh, well, I mean, he's clearly off his rocker with a lot of this stuff. He hasn't done, he listened to Flint Dibble, which is going to make the video really easy, because when I respond to it, because once again, listening to Flint Dibble is a great way to put your foot in your mouth. he just misinformed the guy. Yeah. And then, I mean, one of the best examples of how off Professor Dave was, for if this is what's going to pass a scientific discourse and Professor Dave explaining, I don't even know what where we're at nowadays. His words about the racism thing is just like, you know, it just is racist. You know, the Atlantis hunting just is.
Yeah.
Well, okay, cool. Look at the trees, man. God must be. Look at the pyramid. Must be made by aliens. Just is. It's like, fuck, man, that ain't an argument, dude. That's just.
Yeah. And this guy, of course, isn't a professor.
No, he's just some guy. He's just a YouTuber.
He's actually a fraud.
Well, yeah.
presenting himself to be something that he isn't, and at the same time projecting his own fraudulence onto others and accusing them of being frauds.
And he's a nasty one, man. I mean, yeah. I can get ugly, but that guy is, whoa, he is mean.
It's quite offensive to the ear. The thing that disturbs me isn't so much that. I understand people with very negative outlooks who are just looking to make money. I get that. What bothers me about it is the way that the academic community circles the wagons around these people, both in the case of Milo Rossi, Mini Minuteman, and now in the case of this so-called Professor Dave, and in the case of Flint Dibble, it's been shown that he's stated things that were not true, and he used those deliberately in the debate. A responsible profession would not allow its members to lie publicly in that way. A responsible profession would step in and say, actually, this is bad for the whole profession. But that's not happened in archaeology. Again and again, they circle the wagons around him. And even people who aren't archaeologists seem to be so afraid of the power of the archaeological lobby that they circle the wagons too. And I want you to talk a little bit about your encounter with Peter Neff, the Ice Age scientist.
Yeah, the ice core specialist.
The ice core specialist, yes. and Flint Dibble's comments about ice cores. Tell us a bit about that. That was
frustrating. Okay, so Dr. Peter Neff is one of the very few ice core specialists on the planet. He goes and collects ice core data. He's qualified to take it to a lab. He's got TikTok stuff and whatnot. He's generally speaking is one of the non-political science-y types on the internet. I reached out to him to make sure that I had my ducks in a row, because what Flint had said about the metallurgy, when he put the wrong graph up there, I smelt the rotten. Something's rotten. So I wanted to make sure I had my info right. So I talked to this Dr. Neff guy. Spends an hour with me on Zoom, gives me all the information, and I portray them basically in a nutshell. If they find lead in an ice core and they don't have an archaeological site to associate with it, they won't call it human-made lead. So what Flint said was basically bullshit, because they will never say that there was metallurgy, no matter how much lead they find, unless they find an archaeological site to go along with it. So that's what I was trying to make sure with Dr. Neff. So Dr. Neff tells me that's right. I put it in a video. Flint reaches out to him, and immediately he waffles. He doesn't waffle enough to where he just says he doesn't completely agree with what I say. He's vague about it. and then leaves it at that and asks me to please never utter his name again, which I haven't until now. But
I saw the exchange. Basically, yeah. Flint scared him off.
Completely. And I don't understand.
He said, what did
he
say? This guy, do you know this guy is a pseudoscientist or something like that?
Yeah, he even said, and this is one thing that was really infuriating, because I had communicated with Flint quite a bit before this, and he knew that I'm not a big fan of ancient high technology, and I certainly don't believe in Ice Age metallurgy.
Yeah.
So when he told Dr. Neff, he said, be careful, this guy's asking that question to prove of ancient high technology. He knew that was a lie.
Yeah.
And he had no problem saying it in order to scorch the earth so that I couldn't talk to a scientist.
Yeah.
In order to, and let me be real clear about this. Flint, Dan Falou, a bunch of these assholes, if you talk to them on Twitter, they will still tell you right now the wrong things about metallurgy and how they determine metallurgy in the Ice Age. They will lie to their science educators. They will lie to the public about the science in order to save Flint Dibble's face. It is, as a guy who's really into science, it's like I've got traitors in my camp. It's infuriating.
Yeah. What do you think is the way forward from here? We live in a world that's very divided right now. There's lots of divisions. Republicans, Democrats here in America, conservative and Labour in Britain, Russia and Ukraine, whatever. I mean, we live in a divided, headbutting kind of world, and in a sense, what's happening in the realm of our studies of the past is a manifestation of that, of people just doing anything to destroy perceived enemies. Do you see a way forward? Is there some positive way out of this?
I see a couple of things that could, a couple of things that need to happen. One, we kind of need to, not kind of, we need to lance the boil. We needed to get it where, like you showed the person earlier lamenting that Ancient Apocalypse was allowed to be on Netflix, and this is why we need state-controlled TV. Well, you go back 40 years, you didn't see dumbasses like Flint Dibble putting their foot in their mouth and sullying the name of their field. You saw the Carl Sagans of the world. And so, The internet, it's a mixed bag both ways that way, and we need them to quit circling the wagons and for them to basically let the people that hang themselves out to dry go get hung out to dry so that they maintain the prestige of their field.
Yeah.
The other thing that needs to happen, in my opinion, and this is on a more philosophical level, but I do talk about this a bit, broadly speaking, there's two sides to the human psyche when you come to things like this. There's really a dreamer side and a skeptical side. And that's not that the dreamers are way out there. I mean, Einstein was a dreamer in these regards. My favorite quote to illustrate this is his, where he, about 5 years after relativity was a thing, he says, I can barely recognize the theory of relativity now that the mathematicians have gotten hold of it.
Yeah.
Right? It took his dreaming, but then it took these hardline skeptics, those assholes that come in there and pick at things. So they're supposed to do that with integrity and honesty.
Yes.
They're not supposed to do it with ego. And that's really, the whole scientific method's based around removing human ego from the equation. It recognizes that I see things differently than you, than they. And so when these guys inject their ego strong into it, I digress. But we'll never move forward if we don't combine both halves of our psyche that way. We need the shamans and we need the scientists.
I totally agree. We need both. Archaeology does do a lot of fantastically useful work, really, really valuable. And there are a lot of great archaeologists with good hearts, but the whole profession is being poisoned by a small group of arrogant bullies, basically, who will do anything to quote-unquote win. It's most unfortunate.
It's an impossible thing. Science never rests on its laurels. Science is always moving. Even the theory of gravity, the theory of relativity, the electromagnetic theory, germ disease theory, all these things are always, there's always something being researched. Nothing is ever set in stone.
Yeah.
So when they come around and they just try to sell this, we know for a fact, as soon as that comes out of a scientist's mouth, you're not talking to a scientist anymore. You're talking to a charlatan in a lab's coat. He's just selling you a bill of goods.
Yeah, yeah. So when can we look forward to the Professor Dave video?
As soon as I get back, it's next on the agenda. I was bummed that he released it so close to this trip. So
I saw that you tweeted about it, that he'd built a nice pyre for himself.
I try not to endorse positions that I don't feel like I can die on that hill. It's going to take you a while to get me off of it anyway. There's nothing. Everything that I've seen that he said about me was misrepresentation, yeah. straw man. And from what people have sent me, what he said about you and Jimmy was basically the same kind yeah. of thing. He's just yeah. off in the weeds listening to what Flint has to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, and when you for an example of how off the rocker Flint can be, when you said that I'm not talking about this like really high technology, Flint's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Yeah, you are. Yeah. And he makes a video going, yes, you are, because that's what we all know. That's what you mean, Graham. It's like, OK, erect the windmill and go back at tilting. Here we go.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
No, real it's archaeology.
Real archaeology, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, Dan, I'm really glad that you're doing what you're doing. I think you've brought a fresh new perspective into this field, which we badly needed. And more power to your elbow, and keep on going with it.
Thank you. Thanks, Greg. Thank you.